the Joint Committee on Public Safety. It's Wednesday, February 27. Tonight, we're going to have our committee staff walk us through House Bill 3194. House Bill 3194 is the bill which would implement the recommendations of the Governor's Commission on Public Safety, Package 1. And before we get into the details, I just want to make a couple comments. First, we will not be taking testimony tonight. We will, over the course of the next several weeks, be taking extensive testimony on this bill. In addition to other proposals, we have House Bill 3195, which is the alternative draft proposed by District Attorneys Association. We also have other legislation before this committee around the general theme of public safety reform, and we will be hearing those bills as well. So we are not limiting this committee's work to the public commission's, the Governor's Commission recommendations. Tonight, we are limited to House Bill 3194, and I'm going to ask Mr. Nasby to go through the bill, which is long, and not read it, but basically let the committee know what the key elements are, what they would do. And Mr. Prinz is also here somewhere to where and as necessary put this language into plain English for those of us on the committee and elsewhere. So with that, Mr. Nasby, would you like to start?
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. As co-chair Garrett just indicated, House Bill 3194 implements the Public Safety Commission recommendations. There are 19 of them. I'm going to spend a little bit of time with each one. Feel free to interrupt me at any time with questions, and I'll do the best I can with those. Before I get into the 19 recommendations, though, I did want to spend just a minute discussing the sentencing guidelines grid. I know many of you are intimately familiar with it, but I thought it would be helpful to sort of revisit that as an initial matter, because we will be talking about the grid quite a bit tonight and presumably as the committee continues its work. So I've placed in your materials a color copy of the grid that was obtained from the Criminal Justice Commission website. The grid is a two-dimensional tool that applies to most but not all felony crimes in Oregon. If you look at the top of the grid going across the vertical axis, there's A through I are the letters, those are the categories, and those reflect an individual offender's criminal history. The I being on the far right, that is for offenders without any criminal history. The A being on the far left is the sort of most severe criminal history. That's for offenders who have three or more person felonies. So that's the criminal history scale. Going up and down the left-hand side there, you'll see the crime seriousness scale, and that's what we'll be spending some time talking about. And so how the grid works is, in a simple case with an offender convicted of one count, the court and the parties would plug in the offender's criminal history, they would plug in the crime seriousness scale, and they would arrive at one of these boxes. And the boxes describe presumptive sentences. So it's important to note that the yellow area represents prison terms in months. So just as an example, if we look at where 6 and A intersect, the presumptive sentence is a range between 25 and 30 months. Below the yellow area, there's a black dispositional line which separates these presumptive prison terms from presumptive probation terms. And the numbers in the probation term boxes reflect the available sanction units that the court can impose and the supervisory authority can impose during supervision. One more important thing to note about the grid, these sentences are presumptive, which means that the court is not required to impose the presumptive sentence. After an offender is convicted, there's litigation that ensues, and it's possible for the court to make a finding to go both up and down from the presumptive sentence. On the downside, the court can, if it finds substantial and compelling reasons to do so, it can reduce the length of a prison sentence, a presumptive prison sentence. That's called a downward durational department. It can also reduce the presumptive sentence to probation, and that's called a downward dispositional departure. On the upside, the court has the ability It's usually going to require an admission by the defendant or a finding of fact by a jury. But once that happens, the court has the ability to, in the prison terms, impose twice the presumptive sentence. So again, using my example in 6A, if an offender is convicted of 6A, the court makes the necessary findings, it has the ability to impose a sentence that doesn't exceed 60 months. So short version, we're using the grid. We plug in the offender's criminal history, the crime series and scale. We get a presumptive sentence. From that presumptive sentence, the parties have an opportunity to convince the court to impose a higher or lesser sentence. And so I think that's sort of grid 101. If anyone has any questions about that, I'd be happy to answer them. If not, I will continue ahead to the bill. In the bill, House Bill 3194, it tracks the Public Safety Commission's policy recommendations. There are 19 of them. The numbering corresponds. So if you flip through the recommendations to the governor, you'll see the first one has the same caption as the caption on page 2 of the bill, which is weight thresholds for marijuana. And what this section does is it classifies all marijuana offenses, so we're talking possession, delivery, and manufacture, all except for one, based on weight. And if you turn to page 4 of the bill, we've got the sort of the gradations based on weight and the corresponding crime categories. So if we're looking at page 15, we see that there are certain violations that are crime category 4. And so you would
line
plug
15.
Line 15.
Yeah, thank you very much. Page 4, line 15. On down, it assigns crime seriousness categories to the various weight thresholds established under federal law. Now, the one exception to the rule that all possession, delivery, and manufacture of marijuana offenses are treated the same is found on lines 22 to 23, and that is the felony of delivering marijuana to a minor. That's classified as a crime category 6 on the grid, regardless of the weight. Turning to page 5,
just for clarification, sure. So that the reference in that line to ORS 475.860, that's incorporating the reference to the crime of delivery to a minor. Is that what you're saying?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, that is correct.
Okay.
So that's the extent of the marijuana changes. I should note that these sentencing changes, like all of the sentencing changes in the bill, apply to initial sentences imposed on or after the effective date of the bill. If the bill becomes law, the measure will be implemented immediately and begin applying to offenders sentenced for the first time on the date the bill becomes law. So that's what Section 2 says in a nutshell. Moving on to the second recommendation from the commission, Section 3 of the bill directs the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission to classify a violation of felony driving while suspended as a crime category 4 on the grid. You can see there under current law it's a 6. If there are no questions, I'll keep moving along to the third recommendation, which involves sentences for robbery in the second degree, assault in the second degree, and sexual abuse in the first degree. The amendments in these three sections of the bill remove these three crimes from the mandatory minimum sentencing provisions in ORS Chapter 137. There's sort of two effects to this. The first is that rather than being subject to a mandatory minimum, an offender convicted of any of these three crimes would be sentenced according to the sentencing guidelines grid. And so just for your information, assault 2 and robbery 2 are currently classified as a level 9 on the grid, and the committee has asked me to amend the bill to direct the commission to classify sexual abuse in the first degree as a 9 as well. So removing these three crimes from ORS 137, 700, and 707 will mean that those crimes going forward will be sentenced as a crime serious level 9. The second effect from deleting these crimes, or specifically from 137.707, is that 15, 16, and 17-year-olds who are accused of committing assault in the second degree, robbery in the second degree, or sexual abuse in the first degree will begin in juvenile court, where the juvenile court, on motion of the state, will have the opportunity to transfer them to the adult court for criminal prosecution. But instead of mandating that these 15, 16, 17-year-olds charged with these three crimes begin in criminal court, the removal of those crimes from 137.707 starts the proceeding in juvenile court.
137.707 is what?
When Measure 11 was, co-chairs, members of the committee, when Measure 11 was adopted in 1994, I think the very following, the session that followed, so I think the 95 session, the Legislative Assembly split it up into several parts. So 137.700 is the adult version. Okay. 137.707 is the juvenile-specific version, so 15, 16, and 17-year-olds.
Those are the statutes that we took for implementing Measure 11 that went in effect in April of 95.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I believe that's correct. If there are no questions on this portion of the bill, I'll go ahead and move on to the fourth policy recommendation from the Public Safety Commission. And here we deal with two statutes. Earlier I mentioned that there's a number of statutes that remove crimes under certain conditions from the sentencing guidelines grid. So Measure 11 is one of those, but also at least the first statute we're going to talk about, which is commonly referred to as the repeat property offender statute. And under current law, repeat property offenders can fall into one of two classes based on the crime of conviction, and the court's required to strike that. The presumptive sentence for these two classes is 24 months and 18 months, respectively. The amendments in the bill provide the court with a range, 19 to 24 months and 13 to 18 months, respectively. So much like the sentencing guideline grid offers the court a presumptive sentencing range.
At what page are we on?
15.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Much like the sentencing guidelines, the amendments to this statute give the court a range from which of prison terms from which to choose from, and here it's 19 to 24 months. Just sort of a couple things worth noting. On page 17, lines 20 through 32 describe the circumstances under which the court can impose less than the presumptive sentence under the repeat property offender scheme. And I only point it out because it's slightly different than the substantial and compelling reasons the court needs to find to oppose a downward departure under the guidelines. But the process is still the same. It's just the specific findings the court is required to make differ. Also sort of interesting is if we look at 33, and I'm still on page 17, if we look at lines 33 to 40, this is sort of a codification of the Buchholz rule that we briefly talked about last time. So it operates in the repeat property offender statute the same way that it does under the sentencing guidelines.
What lines were you on again?
I'm on page 17, and Buchholz is lines 33 to 40. And so that's the property offender statute. On page 18, section 10, we turn to the repeat drug offender statute. And what this statute does is it prohibits the court. It retains the sentence from the sentencing guidelines grid, but it prohibits the court on a person's second conviction for delivering this sort of long list of manufacturing or drug-related offenses. On the second conviction, it prohibits the court from imposing a downward departure. So the court is required to impose at least the presumptive sentence on that second conviction. The amendments to the bill limit that rule to persons who deliver a controlled substance other than marijuana to a minor. So what that means is if the bill becomes law, Section 10 will prohibit a court from imposing less than the presumptive sentence on a person's second conviction for unlawful delivery of a controlled substance other than marijuana to a minor.
You might need to say that again.
Okay, thank you. Will do. So the amendment to the bill removes a number of crimes for which the court is prohibited from imposing a downward departure. The only the only exception to that rule is for unlawfully delivering a controlled substance other than marijuana to a minor. When a person comes before the court for the second time for a conviction for that offense, the court is prohibited from imposing less than the presumptive sentence. In all of the other, for all other drug offenders who come before the court on a second offense, the court has the ability, if it makes, if it finds substantial and compelling reasons, to impose less than the presumptive sentence.
Thanks.
Yeah, sure. Any other questions? Okay. Turning to page 19, the fifth policy recommendation from the commission is entitled Transitional Leave. Transitional leave is a program by which inmates are released under current law 30 days early after they secure an employment, educational, or other transitional opportunity in the community. There are two amendments, two significant amendments to the transitional leave program in the bill. The first is it extends the period, the length of the transitional leave, the maximum length of the transitional leave, from 30 days to 90 days. The second change is it directs the Department of Corrections to work with the local supervisory authority to proactively assist the inmate in identifying employment, educational, or other transitional opportunities in the community. So that's transitional leave. The sixth recommendation of the commission is entitled Earn Time. It amends, well, I should start by saying the current law under Earn Time is in transition. It will sunset July 1 of this year. Earn Time can be granted by the department for appropriate institutional behavior and participating in basic skills programs. When the inmates do that, the department is authorized to grant them a reduction in their sentence. Under current law, today, that reduction can be 30% for a limited class of offenders. When that law sunsets July 1 of 2013, the maximum amount of earned time will be 20%, but it will cast a wider net and apply to more offenders. The amendments in the bill retain the wide net, but increase the maximum amount of earned time to 30% of the sentence. Another amendment in the bill directs the department to...
Just for clarification, we're not really talking about an amendment,
right?
You're talking about an amendment to the bill, but we don't have amendments to the bill.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I apologize. The statute is amended?
Yes, I think it's just... Thank you.
And I have a question. So it'll increase the widen the net of people eligible for 30%. Will that include violent people in for violent crime?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, their earned time does not apply to Measure 11 offenders, to folks sentenced under what's called Denny Smith. It's 137.635. Measure 57 contained a provision limiting earned time to 20%, I think, for certain offenders. So... does that answer your question, Representative Barker?
It does. Thank you.
Okay. So any other additional questions on earned time?
I don't know. I mean, it's worth pointing out.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. I don't know where to begin. So Assault 2, of course, there's the escape hatch under Measure 11, and so it's a bit persnickety to point it out, but I do need to say that, I mean, some Measure 11 convicts, if the escape hatch of Assault 2 had been, you know, implemented during the course of their sentencing, would in fact be eligible for earned time.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I believe that's absolutely correct. Under current law, the opt-out of 137.717.112 allows the court to impose less than the Measure 11 sentence in certain circumstances. When that happens, those offenders are eligible for earned time. The other point, I think, is that, piggybacking on this, is that by removing robbery 2, assault 2, and sexual abuse 1 from the statutory codification of Measure 11, as we talked about earlier in the bill, those offenders would be eligible for earned time.
What else besides earned time do they become eligible for by coming out of Measure 11? Are there other?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I'm certain there are other exclusions. I think, you know, AIP is another one.
Transitional?
I don't believe there's a limit on transitional. There is. Strike that. I apologize. There is. So
they would become eligible for earned time, AIP, and transitional leave by virtue of no longer being in the Measure 11 statute.
Correct.
Okay.
Moving along to AIP. AIP is the Alternative Incarceration Program. There's a boot camp component, but I think primarily it's a treatment program in the Department of Corrections. The amendments to current law make AIP an opt-out rather than an opt-in, which means when an offender is sentenced to more than 1 year, if the offender is eligible for AIP and there's a statutory list of criteria that's amended in the bill, if they're statutorily eligible, they're allowed to participate in the program unless the court finds substantial and compelling reasons to prohibit them from doing so. I think it's important to note that under AIP, it's possible for the offender to receive a reduction in the prison term of up to 20%, but that the court at sentencing is able to limit that 20%. So AIP is, generally speaking, a treatment program that, with the court's permission, the offender is allowed to, if the offender successfully completes the treatment program, the offender is allowed to receive a reduction in the sentence. And so what the amendments in the bill do is make participation in the AIP program the default unless the court finds substantial and compelling reasons to prohibit the offender from participating.
Does this change the eligibility for the program?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, it's a burden shift.
Right.
Under current law, it's been characterized as an opt-in program. The offender has to demonstrate that the offender is eligible. The amendments in the bill flip that burden to the state, so it will be the state's job to demonstrate that the offender is ineligible.
Okay. And if I can follow up on that, Josh, I believe that's how it was before we were under current law, meaning the original program actually had it as what we'll be reverting back to what it used to be prior to the switch, which occurred about six or eight years ago.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, absolutely correct. I believe it was 2008. There was a House bill that...
And that's all centers around a particular case that happened in Lane County.
Thank you.
Moving along. Policy option number 8. I'm on page 24. I'm on the bottom of page 24.
Excuse me.
There are a number of amendments in the bill to what's called second look, and I'm going to describe second look under current law, and then we'll talk about the amendments. Under current law, juvenile offenders sentenced to more than 2 years in prison for a crime other than a Measure 11 crime and other than murder are reviewed after having served half of their sentence. The court conducts a full-blown hearing, and the court can either order the offender to serve the remainder of the sentence or release the offender on what's called conditional release. It's a supervised release. The bill does two things. First, it authorizes juvenile offenders, and again, we're talking 15, 16, and 17, who are convicted of Measure 11 crimes to be eligible for second look. The other thing the bill does is it, for those offenders who are denied second look, after having served three-fourths of the sentence imposed, the court can conduct another hearing to determine whether the offender should be conditionally released or serve the last one-fourth of the sentence.
Is that true, all offenders?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, yes. So the under current law, non-Measure 11s get a review at half of their sentence.
Right.
The bill gives everyone a review at three-fourths and allows Measure 11 offenders to be reviewed at one-half.
Thank you.
Including murder.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, because murder is sentenced differently, murder is not included. So,
just needed that for the record.
Fair enough. For your information, persons convicted of murder generally serve life sentences, but they're 25 to life, so they'll serve 25 years, at which point they'll be before the parole board. And so the bill, nothing in the bill applies to folks who are convicted of murder.
Who initiates the second look review process?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, it's actually the Department of Corrections or the Oregon Youth Authority. So it's statutorily required after having served half the sentence imposed, the department, I believe they file a motion to initiate the process.
Okay.
So moving on to page 21, we're on policy recommendation number 9. It's entitled Community Corrections Earned Discharge.
No, we're not on page 21. It's page...
20.
Page 31.
31, sorry.
Thank you. The Community Corrections Earned Discharge provisions authorize persons sentenced to felony probation or to less than a year in prison. And I'm going to stop, actually. It's important to note that the general rule of thumb is that persons sentenced to more than a year are the responsibility of the state. They go to the Department of Corrections. Persons sentenced to less than a year are the responsibility of the local authorities. So the class of persons we're talking about are under the jurisdiction of the local supervisory authority. So the bill provides that these folks sentenced to a year or less or probation can receive a 50% reduction in the period of probation or post-prison supervision for complying with the terms of supervision, including the payment of restitution, and participating in recidivism reduction programs. By way of comparison, there's a current provision of law that I believe is scheduled to sunset in July 1 of 2013 that allows the same class of offenders to receive... It's still a 50%, but it's not a reduction in the sense that probation is terminated. Rather, under current law, these folks become inactive. So the change from the law today is that this earned discharge program will terminate probation for an offender who complies with the rules up to 50% of the term of probation. Section 30 at the bottom of page 31 amends the Community Corrections Grant Program, and the intent of the amendment is to ensure that local jurisdictions aren't penalized for folks earning discharge from their supervision. So the amendment's designed to say to community corrections agencies, the formula is calculated on the number of offenders you're required to supervise, but not necessarily the duration for which you supervise them.
That's now, but it will change, so they'll be paid, like, it will say you get 100 months probation and you're doing well, so they cut you off at 50, but they would still, the local would still get the money for the 100.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, that's correct. That's the intent of the amendment.
Okay, thank you.
So turning to page 32, this is recommendation number 10. It involves structured sanctions, and here we're talking about folks convicted of a felony and sentenced to probation. What the amendments in these portions of the bill do is they prohibit the court from operating in a way that bars the local supervising agency from using structured sanctions.
Could you explain what that means? Yeah. That's a term that we heard a lot in the commission process, but I'm not sure everybody understands what structured sanctions means.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, when an offender violates probation, they can be arrested, and I presume this can apply even if they're not arrested, but there's a violation. And the supervisory authority, the parole and probation officer, can impose what are called structured intermediate sanctions. They can be jail time. They can be UAs, urine analysis regularly. It's a whole range of penalties that can be imposed by the probation officer. And so what the bill does is it says the probation officer is going to determine in the first instance whether or not a court hearing is necessary. The probation officer will have the opportunity to impose structured sanctions on the offender. The probation officer will also have the opportunity, if they don't choose to go down that route, to bring the offender before a judge. But the point of the amendments is that the court can't prohibit the probation officer from imposing structured sanctions if the probation officer thinks that's appropriate. There's one exception to that rule. When an offender's charged with committing a new crime, the court can issue a warrant and yank them in and sanction them for violating probation.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Hicks.
And this may be a better question for Mr. Prinz, I don't know, but do we have an idea of how many counties do not currently use a structured sanctions kind of arrangement? And I wouldn't ask him to come up and tell the chair and feel appropriate. Maybe if he's coming up at the end, we can just put that
in. I was
going
to ask him to come up at the end and just provide some context for what we're hearing, but if that's all right with you,
that'll work.
We can wait.
I'll save it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, also, Josh, on the structured sanctions, aren't the probation officers limited to the amount of jail that they can actually impose? I want to say it's like 10 days or 30 days or something. I forget. There's a limit of how many jail days they can have. So if we don't have that information now, we should probably have that.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Mr. Prince can correct me if I'm wrong. I think these on the sentencing guideline grids, when we're looking at the felony probation, the lower number reflects jail days, the higher number reflects non-jail sanction units. So they are limited in terms of what they can do. But
we'll wait till Craig gets up.
So returning to page 34, policy recommendation number 11, it's entitled Supervision Conditions. Under current law, when the court sentences a person convicted of a felony to probation, the law requires the court to include certain conditions of probation unless the court determines otherwise. But the court is also empowered to impose what are called special conditions of probation. And they're sort of just very specific conditions of probation that the offender is required to comply with. What the amendments in this section of the bill do is they transfer the authority to impose special conditions of probation from the court to the probation officer. And so the amendments require the probationer to submit to a risk and needs assessment within 3 days of being sentenced to probation, and thereafter the probation officer has an additional couple of days to determine what the special conditions of probation are, to impose them, and to notify the court of those conditions. And so now we're going to move ahead to page 42. Policy recommendation number 12, it's an oversight entity, and it's basically a task force designed to review House Bill 3194 if it's enacted. It's modeled loosely on the Public Safety Commission. Two House members, two Senate members, two judges, and four members appointed by the governor, one representing law enforcement, one representing community corrections, a district attorney, and a defense attorney, And these folks get together and appoint a public member. And so the task force is required by October 1st of 2016 to submit a report to the Legislative Assembly that may include recommendations and includes an assessment of the implementation of House Bill 3194. Turning the page, we're on policy recommendation number 13 on page 43. This recommendation creates a standardized definition of recidivism, and the definition, the word is defined to mean any arrest, conviction, or incarceration within a 3-year period, either of the conviction or if the offender's sentenced to prison within 3 years of being released. And the bill directs public bodies in Oregon who study recidivism to include a study utilizing this definition anytime they examine the issue. And so the point here is that if there a public body in Oregon is conducting a study of recidivism, they're not limited to this definition, but if they anytime they study it, they're required to include this definition. And so I know that was not particularly coherent, but if, for example, the FBI determined that a 5-year window was, they wanted that from the state could comply with that, but they would also need to produce an evaluation of recidivism using the definition in the bill. Turning the page, the top of page 44, this section applies to specialty courts, and those are defined to include drug court programs, veterans courts, mental health courts, and similar courts. And this section of the bill directs the Criminal Justice Commission to work with the Judicial Department to adopt rules applicable to these specialized courts. It directs the Criminal Justice Commission to review these rules every 2 years to ensure they're aligned with best practices. Policy recommendation number 15 involves the correctional forecast produced by the Department of Administrative Services. It directs the department to, whenever possible, identify the forecast margin of error and attribute growth or decline in the forecast to the baseline underlying the forecast. And my understanding is the department looks at a number of factors, including population demographics and crime trends. And so there's sort of a baseline driving the forecast, and so they're required under this amendment to publish that when they issue a state corrections forecast. Policy recommendation number 16 is entitled Program Evaluation, and there are two sort of significant amendments in here. The first amends the definition of cost-effective to require these criminal justice agencies who are subject to the law to assess cost-effectiveness utilizing a tool identified by the Criminal Justice Commission. And the second significant amendment is it directs these agencies to utilize randomized controlled trials when possible and appropriate. So it modifies the way criminal justice programs are conducted, are evaluated in this state. Turning to page 46, we've got fiscal impact notes, and the amendment directs the Legislative Fiscal Office to, when it prepares fiscal impact statements related to criminal legislation, to use a 10-year horizon rather than, I believe they currently use a 2-year horizon. So the legislation says look out both in terms of state and local governments for a 10-year period. The bottom of page 46, we'll see policy recommendation number 18. It's entitled Performance Incentive Funding. It goes from sections 51 to 64, but the significant stuff's in the beginning. The amendments or the bill directs the Criminal Justice Commission to administer a Community Corrections Incentive Grant Program. And so there are two forms of grants that community corrections folks can apply for. The first involves supervise, incarcerating and supervising offenders sentenced to 15 years or less. I'm sorry, I strike that. 15 months or less. As I indicated earlier, the general rule is the state's responsible for folks who get more than a year. The locals are responsible for folks who get a year or less. The bill establishes a grant program so that local folks can apply and receive funding to incarcerate and supervise offenders sentenced to 15 months or less. And many of the sections that follow are designed to ensure that the courts, when they sentence folks to 15 months or less in these counties, sentence them locally rather than to the Department of Corrections. So that's one form of a performance incentive grant that a county can apply for. The other form requires the county to demonstrate that they're going to successfully be able to reduce the use of Department of Corrections resources through the creation or expansion of locally based sanctions, services, and programs. And so the Criminal Justice Commission is tasked with administering this program. If they accept a county into the program, they can provide initial startup funds so the county can get the program going. And then there are annual assessments of the rate at which the county has lessened its use of Department of Corrections resources. And there's a funding mechanism for counties who hit that target. And there's also one for counties who miss that target, but there is sort of a penalty provision in the bill so that they get fewer funds if they miss those targets than if they hit the targets. One minor thing to note is that there's two counties in the state where the Department of Corrections operates supervisory authorities, and so in those two counties, the department is authorized to apply to participate in the grant. And finally, on page 53, we see policy recommendation number 19, which directs the Department of Corrections to submit a report no later than October of next year that identifies cost containment solutions by which the department can reduce operational costs by 5% over a 10-year period. And that's excluding inflation, excluding capital construction, excluding bonding. It's simply operational costs. So the department's required to submit a report identifying how to cut 5% out of the budget over the next 10 years. And with that, I will happily answer any questions you may have.
And I have, so in a juvenile who's charged in robbery two, for example, now they go, that starts out in juvenile court, so they may not even get to adult court?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, that's absolutely correct.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Nasby. And just, before Mr. Prince comes up, just a couple comments. So as you heard, there are 19 different concepts in the bill. They're kind of easily grouped into five different areas, and you see that on your agenda. And what the co-chairs met on Thursday, and what we thought made sense was to proceed with having public hearings by subject matter, so that as we get into the concepts in the bill that deal with sentencing changes, for example, we would have a hearing focused on that. And that would also be an opportunity for other bills on the same subject to be brought forward. We would have a hearing on all of them at once. So we'll be doing that over the next several meetings. We will also be taking the opportunity at most of our meetings to hear from those hear proposals for reinvestment, since this is the purpose of this effort is to begin to reallocate resources toward investment. We want to hear about what those ideas for reinvestment are. We'll also be integrating those into our meetings going forward. So we'll be having much more detailed hearings on what Mr. Nasby just went through, but for now I thought it would be helpful if Mr. Prinz wanted to come up and just finish our session tonight with kind of a overview of how these sections of the bill implement the commission recommendations.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. I'm Craig Prinz from the Criminal Justice Commission. I think Josh did a great job of going through this. There's a lot of information. I wanted to just try to answer some of the questions that came up, hit some of the context of this, and then see if there are any other questions that came up. Josh did a good job of explaining the guidelines. I think what's important to remember about the guidelines is the guidelines were enacted in 1989. They were intended to cover all felony convictions. And today, because we have the statutory overlays that we've had over the years, and we've changed those statutory overlays, and then we've temporarily changed those statutory overlays, what you've got now is the guidelines really only, the way I would put it is, the guidelines control about less than a quarter of our use of prisons. So most of the folks that are being sent to prison for a term of years, they're going through the statutory processes that we've created since 1989. So I think it's important to understand the guidelines have always been there, and they're still the way we do sanctions, and they're still the way we do a lot of the way probation and post-prison supervision work. But the decision about who goes to prison for how long has really been changed, and it's really more about the statutes that we've put in place since then. Those statutory overlays that we've created and the legislature's created are where you'd see Measure 57, you'd see the robbery and assault and sex abuse. What we see since those statutes have come online, really you see a lot of, and I think Justice DeMunez and Representative Krieger talked about this, a lot of then who goes to prison is not not in the judge's hands. It's more in the negotiation before there's a conviction that occurs in the district attorneys and with some judicial oversight of the plea bargaining. But to give you a context of that, when we looked at Measure 11, we're talking 70% of these cases are plea bargained out of their initial charge that would have a mandatory minimum sentence for Measure 11. And so you can see a theme of this is we're really trying to get the legal structure back to where there are a legal structure for having case-by-case individual decision-making, and also on the conditions of probation that Josh talked about, you'd have a case-by-case assessment of the individual offender to see what's the best plan for reducing the likelihood that they'll commit crime in the future. If I said that's basically the general theme of this whole thing as far as the sentencing is moving from a legal system that's kind of one size fits all on a lot of things and letting the courts kind of handle it informally is we'd have more of a formal structure for parole and probation, or post-prison supervision and probation, and the sentencing, to have an individualized look at some of these important decisions. The other area I was going to say is really important is we've talked about how this. We've talked about the forecast a lot, and we've talked about our use of prison beds a lot. And I want to make sure you understand that when Josh talks about the baseline forecast, the baseline is all of the things I've talked about. So it's Measure 11 and the sentencing guidelines and local control where we had the sheriffs take the offenders who are going to sentence for less than 12 months and Measure 57, and then when we took Measure 57 off, all of that is mostly in what we would call the baseline. It's all the things that we did up till 2008. So in other words, the way the forecast is built, 99% of the beds we use right now are baseline. And that's why then we look at what's going to grow us from where we are right now, which is 14,200 beds. What's going to grow us the next 2,300 beds? That's more about the Measure 57 and the nonviolent offenders. And I think sometimes we have an artificial distinction between those. Those are all prison beds. It's just like when in anything, when we're talking about new things, new changes, we tend to focus on those. But I don't want you to miss that the bulk of the beds are through this process that we've developed over the last 20 years. Representative Hicks, on your point about the structured sanctions, most all counties use some system of structured sanctions so that, and this is kind of what Oregon is a national model of, the structured sanctions that the supervisory authority have gives us the ability to swiftly sanction and modify behavior. So when you hear about, for example, Hope Court, and I think Hope Court is great, but the key for that program in Hawaii, they don't have the ability for the probation officer to intervene quickly. They'd have to bring every case back to the court. We have a system where, in most cases, the parole or probation officer can take care of it immediately, swiftly, and that we know is how we change human behavior, is not, you know, you messed up and we're going to have a hearing in 2 months about what's the penalty for that. So in most counties, that's what we do. I would say the thing that the commission heard a lot of testimony about was, in some cases, in some offenders, the plea agreement will ask the offender to stipulate to not do that structured sanctioning. And it's basically, if there's one violation on probation, you're going to go to prison. And some folks would call that a zero tolerance probation and things. And what we heard testimony about is, as we've made more and more of the nonviolent offenders eligible for prison, more and more of them are being asked to make a, if they do get a departure sentence, they would have a stipulation. So I think your question, Representative Hicks, is a good question, and I know you were a deputy DA like I was, and so I know you're looking a bit more detailed. So counties still use structured sanctions. What this policy was to make sure that we don't have stipulations by individual offenders that would negate the ability of the parole and probation officer to make swift, sure, short sanctions. And so I hope that it was more of an individual distinction of an individual case than a county by county. I think that's what I wanted to highlight from just kind of the comments of where we were. This again is the package that allows it was called Package One when you looked at it on this would allow us to control the growth as it is placed in the governor's budget, and this package would allow us then to reinvest in the local communities that are really where we see a real dire need for investment in local systems. And we really think that that combination would allow us to keep folks safe in Oregon, using less taxpayer dollars, and would allow us to build up that local response that really is what Oregon is held up as a model of. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any further questions? We're off. Plenty of time coming up. Oh, Representative Hicks. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And can Mr. Prince provide us with a sense of how often the AIP and the early release programs are being used currently?
Mm-hmm. Co-chairs, Representative Hicks, great question. AIP was established in 2001 or 2003. It was used quite a bit then. In 2008... we passed a bill in the February special session that really changed AIP as far as who gets in and how long, if they were successful, they could reduce their sentence. My point of saying that is it has dramatically changed how often people get in and if they complete it. So I will have to look at it and see. When we passed Measure 57... we were considering a situation where we wanted to make sure that the offender was in prison long enough to engage in the treatment. But what we've seen in the last 5 years since that passed is really they're not getting into AIP as much as they used to be. And it's I don't know if it's because of the presumption was changed of whether they enter or not, or whether it's just a change in how the corrections practice is, or a change in the plea bargaining of whether this individual offender is eligible. That I can get back to you on and see, because it really is in flux, basically. Mm-hmm. It's really changed in the last 5 years.
I've got two more, actually.
Oh, go for it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, and I didn't prep you with any
of these,
so I definitely don't. So it sounds like I would think something like 90-something percent of all cases settle.
Yeah.
You know, and 70% of Measure 11 cases that are charged initially as Measure 11 cases settle. And so, you know, how many cases ultimately go to prison? And this is, by all means, you need to look into this, look it back. Mm-hmm. To me, please. But so how many prisoners are actually serving out a Measure 11 sentence? Mm-hmm.
Co-chairs, Representative, this is a great question, because so Measure 11, and you know this, most of the impact is on the plea bargaining process. So whenever we set a sentence in stone, it's really what happens if there is not a negotiation to have an agreement to some other sentence. What Measure 11 changed that we didn't anticipate is most of the pleas are not to, let's say if someone was indicted for robbery in the first degree, now most of the pleas would be an attempted robbery in the first degree, and that really changed it. But what it did change too is what you would serve on an attempted robbery. It really boosted it up. So it's what I would say is you have to look at how many are actually serving the Measure 11 sentence and how many are serving those 70% of cases that are pled down in Measure 11. And it's still it's the bulk of the offenders. So I'll have to get back to you on that. But you have to make sure that you're not just, I think your point is, that you're not just considering those who got convicted and are serving it. It really changed the whole, the structure of how we do this in court. It changed the judge's ability to look at the individual case. And it really changed how the prosecutor decides, am I going to seek a conviction or not? Am I going to seek a conviction for this crime that was indicted, or is it better to seek one for a lesser included offense? I can get you the exact numbers of kind of how many are on it.
Thank you. I'd like that. And I've got. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And did so within the bill, there is, if I heard right, a description of raising, I think, the presumptive prison sentence from 13 to 15 months. Mm-hmm. And so did the, I mean, it often takes longer than a month or two to resolve a prison-bound case. Mm-hmm. And so commonly prisoners are sent, or defendants are sent to prison for a 13-month sentence. Mm-hmm. But they serve far less than that because they've spent a certain amount of time at the county. And so did the commission inquire, or do you have information regarding, so someone serves 4 months waiting on their sentence, and now they're going to DOC for 9 months. I mean, if they stayed at the county, are there fiscal implications to that, or because DOC has to do in processing, and DOC mm-hmm. The state's going to be on the hook? Did the commission delve into this area at all?
Co-chairs, Representative Hicks, yes, the committee did. I think so. When a offender's in jail pending trial, when they get sentenced, it's typical for the judge to allow credit for that time against their sentence. We always go off of sentence. So it's if someone is sentenced for 12 months, but they are in jail for 3 months before they get sentenced, they'll only do 9 months at the Department of Corrections, I think is your point. The Measure 57, the changes really would look at giving a range of the sentence. But yes, what has to happen in every situation is we looked at having the time of the conviction have the judge and the DA and everyone that's in court try to figure out how long is this guy going to serve. So they'd know, well, maybe if he's going to serve only 9 months, we should keep him in a local jail. You can determine it within a few days, but part of how long he's going to stay is his behavior once he's already sentenced. And so we found that it was impossible for the local court to determine how long is this guy going to, you know, how long is he going to actually stay? When will he be released? You can't figure it out to the day because it's you can't know. It's part of it is his behavior. So what we do is we looked at it, and I think that's why in the incentive portion, a county could say, we will take offenders who are going to serve up to 15 months, I think it is, knowing that they would have them in a local jail and they could manage them there. But it's going to, I think, always have to be what they were sentenced to, not what they're going to ultimately serve, because that really is based upon factors that the courts can't figure out right away at sentencing.
Got it.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Chris, Craig, well, I think what I want to do is follow up on what Representative Hicks brought up, because I'd written some notes regarding, because based on what our discussions were, or how people are charged with Measure 11, how the plea agreements and plea negotiations works, and how that really changes the whole landscape. Mm-hmm. So when you're getting the information, it would be interesting not only to have the actual number of individuals going in on a Measure 11 sentence, but also looking at the plea charges in the sense of if they were dropped to an attempt, mm-hmm. what is the number of those individuals that actually are going to prison in the sense of that's the sentence that they receive. Then I think we have to throw in, and this really goes back actually to, I think, part of what Representative Krieger brought up last time, is these cases that are, let's say, a deal is made where the individual gets a probation sentence, but there is the zero tolerance component to it, and then they end up in prison. Mm-hmm. And so what the impact of that, because that seems to me to be a lot of the driving us to the bed spaces that are being used, is that if you have individuals that are basically not going in but for a technical violation on their first technical violation, then you're putting that burden back into the prison system. So I'm not sure if we can get there, but if we could have a range or an average length mm-hmm. of the terms that the individuals that are serving that have a plea bargain sentenced mm-hmm. that actually ends up in DLC, because I think those are the cost drivers. And it really goes back to, again, what Representative Krieger had brought up, that, you know, we have to look at some point where a deal is put on the table as to what that ADA thought at that time was fair, reasonable to resolve that case and holding the person accountable, and what actually is the end result of what they actually serve or don't serve based on those negotiations.
Mm-hmm. We can get co-chairs and Senator Brzezinski. We can get back to you with some, with those numbers.
Representative Krieger,
is the plea bargain that's offered, is there a written thing always? What was offered? That's a public document. You can go look at those.
Yeah, co-chairs, Representative Krieger. When I was a DA, we would have in the paper file, we would have the plea agreement, so that, for example, if I had made a plea offer, then my other deputy DAs would know what that plea offer was if they had to negotiate it. So, yes, it's in the file. And in cases where, let's say, on a non-mandatory case, I went to trial and the offender was convicted, and I'm saying, here's what I think should happen. A lot of times the court would ask me as a young DA, well, what did you offer this offender before trial? And they would want to know that as they're listening to my arguments of what the sentence could be. In a mandatory case, that doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't matter if I had said, I'll offer you probation to plead to a lesser offense, because if the person's convicted of a case that would be holding a mandatory, it doesn't matter what that is. But yes, it is available in the file, and it's a written plea agreement offer.
Okay.
But even in the Measure 11 case, it's in the file?
Mr. Chair, co-chairs, members of the committee, it should be. I mean, we would have it in detail when I was doing it. And then in Multnomah County, where I practiced, a lot of times there would be on the record plea negotiation agreements with a judge, where the judge would be sitting there and they would talk about this plea offer and have the defense attorney and the offender and the DA kind of talk about how they arrived at it and things. And that's all done. But the critical thing is, you know, if there isn't an agreement, then in a mandatory situation, all that's kind of set aside.
Senator Brzezinski.
Following up on that, it's really going to vary from county to county, because when I was in the Lane County District Attorney's Office, if we gave an offer and if they took it, we would put that on the record for the court would know what the offer was. A lot of times we would allow either it would be a mutual or joint offer, meaning both sides are coming in and agreeing this is what we think should happen. Mm-hmm. There are other times where you could the state would actually say this is what we recommend in our negotiations and allow the defense to actually put on maybe an alternative view for the court to make a determination. But I can tell you, as a prosecutor, even in the municipal court level, if I put out an offer and they don't take it, I don't have courts asking me, what did you offer them beforehand? Because, I mean, that's something that was on the table before they were either pled out with no recommendations or have been found guilty either through a court or a jury trial. And to me, I've always taken the position that's moot. And, you know, we're here today to deal with the decisions that were made either by the defendant not taking the offer and how a jury comes back with a conviction.
All right. I see no further questions. Mr. Prince, thank you for
very much
your context.
Thank you.
That's all we have for tonight. So we are adjourned. We'll be back on Friday.